History Project of Orleans County. I am Ethel Willis, interviewing Mrs. Pearl Goss at her home on the Bates Road, Medina, New York. Mrs. Goss, will you please identify yourself?
Non.
Your name?
Well, I was born in 1890 in Beansville, Ontario, Canada. My mother went over there for me to be born because there was no hospital in Medina at that time. And she only stayed 3 weeks. But nevertheless, I had to get my naturalization papers out when the World War was on, or I couldn't cross the border.
And what was your father's name?
Thomas.
Thomas what?
He didn't have a middle name.
What's your last name?
Corner.
Corner. And your mother's name?
Levina.
Levina, and what was her maiden name?
House.
Levina House Corner.
Uh-huh.
And did you have brothers and sisters?
3 sisters. No brothers.
Will you tell me who they were, please?
Mabel.
Who married?
Who married Spencer Kinnard. And
Lula.
Who married Wilson Fox and lives here on the Bates Road next to me. And Inez married William Hickey from Medina.
And the first two of your sisters are still living, are they not? Mabel and Lula?
No, Mabel died.
Oh.
And Inez.
Oh, that's right. Uh-huh. Just you
Inez
and
died.
Lula living.
Inez oh. died.
Where did you go to school?
Where?
Yes.
On Bates Road.
Mm-hmm.
Until, I went to 8th grade. Then I went to about a year in Medina. And they didn't have typing and shorthand those days in school. And so I quit school and went to business school for a year. And then after graduating from business school, I worked in New York Canner's office.
When was the business school that you attended?
Albion.
Albion, a privately run
yes,
school.
Okay.
Yes. And how long did you work at the Canner's?
17 years.
17 years. And you were married when?
1909.
Your husband's name was?
Harry.
Harry Goss.
Mm-hmm.
And he is no longer living?
No. Died in 1943.
And where else have you worked?
Well, after getting through at the office, I started in business on Main Street, Medina.
You never worked for anyone else?
No. Well, previous to my marriage, I worked in Cook's East Center Street office.
I see. And then you started in business for yourself in what year?
1932. And I started in business in the store where Western Auto is now, and later years moved down where the Goodman
mm-hmm.
pharmacy.
And your business was a restaurant?
Restaurant
and
soda.
Which you called?
And soda bar.
A restaurant which you called?
The Maple Leaf.
The Maple Leaf. I remember going there to eat mm-hmm. years ago. How many people, what people worked for you? Who were they?
Well, Belle Fearby, she worked for me for 17 years. She was a cook.
Uh-huh.
And two of her daughters also worked for me in the kitchen. And Mildred Brady and her mother, Mrs. Cross, worked in the kitchen. And out in the store, I had all the young people that ever grew up in Medina.
Including Earl Bear Brady.
Including Earl Bear Brady. And Bernard Dujinsky, Maynard Kinruth, Jim Jennings.
Marion Helen Bolt.
Marion Helen Bolt was with me 12 years.
12 years.
And
until the time that you sold out the business?
Yes, uh-huh. Uh-huh. And I'm trying to think of who else.
Well, you did pretty well to remember that many, I think. One thing that I remember about eating in your restaurant was that during the Depression, you had a 35-cent lunch that was complete with soup and a generous slice of your excellent pie. Didn't you tell me that you used to have turkey dinners for 35 cents?
Complete turkey dinner, including soup and dessert for 35 cents.
And I remember Blanche Nestor used to come in every day for lunch, and her sister, Bess Stewart, who worked at the Gould's Flower Store. Blanche worked at
all the businessmen in town.
Oh, yeah.
And they had, they formed it themselves, breakfast lunch.
Oh.
Breakfast
club.
No, breakfast club. And they called it the Maple Leaf Breakfast Club.
Oh, yes.
And one morning, it was very, very hot weather. They picked up the table, and the tablecloths, and the coffee percolators, and all their food, and went out and on the sidewalk.
Oh, for goodness.
And had breakfast.
Oh, for goodness.
And the waiters came up and took the picture.
Oh, good. Good. I remember Paul Parsons used to eat there, and Gerald Houseman.
Yes.
And Joe Brundage.
Yes, and Leo Collins.
Yes.
And Mr.
And way back, didn't D.W. Wilson used to eat there?
Yes, and Craig Ross.
Yeah.
And Vince Cardone, and I'm just trying to think of the breakfast club. That they
oh, yes.
The breakfast club. Mm-hmm.
And Miss Bigelow, Miss Stella Bigelow used to eat there
she ate
at lunch,
years.
Didn't she?
She never missed a day, I don't think.
Is that right?
Oh, and she know. Always took the lunch out for George Carpenter.
George Carpenter, her very faithful
chauffeur
servant. Yes, yes. And Mrs. Luther used to eat there sometimes, didn't she?
Mrs. Luther always ate.
She did. Well, did Miss Bigelow come in for dinner at night, too?
No, usually at noon.
Uh-huh. I know she was often there at noon when I was there. Well, what interesting things can you remember about that restaurant?
Oh, there's so many things. The young high school kids, those days, you know, they flock in after the dance.
But and they called it the Leaf.
Yes.
They called it the Leaf.
And they'd come in and they'd just, well, have the best time. They'd laugh and tee-hee and just have a crazy time. And they loved it, and I loved to have them because they never did a thing out of order in my place, but across the street at the Mayflower, they steal the sugar bowls and take them out on the street and throw them in the street and did all sorts of things, carved up their, it was forever putting them out of the place. I never had to.
Well, you had a good rapport with the boys and girls. I think the secret of getting along with teenage boys and girls, I've worked with them for many years in the church, and I think the secret of it is to love them.
Yes.
And they know.
Yes.
They know.
They know. And the different boys, now Joe Brundage and well, years afterwards, I'd meet them, you know,
uh-huh.
and they'd tell me what a grand time they used to have at the Maple Leaf.
Yeah, they did, I'm sure. Had a wonderful time. And another one that used to eat in there was Bev Smith's wife, B. Smith.
Every noon.
And later on, during the war, you changed your operation to a cafeteria, didn't you?
Yes. It was difficult to get help.
Uh-huh.
And so I switched over to cafeteria, which was an expense to do. But when you couldn't get help, you just had to do the best thing you could.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And I operated like that until I closed in
1962. 1962.
I was on
30 years.
On Main Street, 30 years.
Uh-huh. You know? And I'm sure you taught Maynard Kenward a lot about what he
did. His mother taught him the most.
Oh, yes.
Maynard used to wait on tables.
Uh-huh. I remember he did.
And Jim Jennings.
Yeah. Yeah. Jim went into the service and was wounded, didn't he?
Yes. He went into the service. And they drafted them, of course. So it
uh-huh.
And Jim had been, he had had his ankle broken. And it was set, but it wasn't healed. And they took him anyway. And Dr.
The local doctor?
Yes. The one on East Center Street, West Center Street there.
McDonald?
Dr. McDonald. Oh, he was very much put out to think they took Jim in the service on account of his leg.
Uh-huh.
His ankle had been broken several times, and they said it was just like a washboard. And they took him anyway. And they kept him in Fort Niagara for, I guess, almost 2 years. And Jim got disgusted, and they kept debating amongst the,
uh-huh.
the officials whether they'd discharge him or take him overseas. And Jim told him, he said, I don't care what you do, but get me out of here, Fort Niagara. And so they sent him overseas. And on V-Day, he was dumped in the strait there. They had that battle, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he was in the water 6 hours, and it did something to that ankle. And after he was discharged and sent home, before he was sent home, he had to have the leg amputated below the knee. And so he's walked with an artificial leg all his years.
And is he still living?
He's still living, and he suffers all the time. He's a pharmacist, and that's why they took him in the army, because they needed him.
I see.
And he met a young man in, well, some of the hospitals over on this side after he got home. And the guy recognized him. And Jim asked him, how come? And he said, well, you wore a moccasin on one foot all through the army.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And that's how he recognized him.
Uh-huh. Well, that's interesting. I didn't know whether Jim was still living or not. Does he live in Medina?
Oh, yes, on Beach Drive.
On Beach Drive. I knew he was. Oh, he does.
Greece, I think. Goes back and forth every day.
Drives?
Well, he drives 1 week and another guy drives. You know,
yeah.
They share.
Is it his right leg? It is, isn't it? It seemed to me that
I think so.
Uh-huh. Well, whichever leg you need it for driving.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Well, you were telling me the other day about two women that came into your restaurant and never were very agreeable. I want to ask you to tell me their names, but tell me about the 10-cent butter deal.
Well, during the war, of course, we had to use stamps to get meat and butter and lard and all
sugar.
And sugar. And these two ladies, they were both school teachers, always had to have extra waiting on, extra everything. And because we couldn't get meat and those articles, you know, they weren't plentiful at all because we couldn't get them. We tried to ration them. All the customers, except those two, gave me their food stamps, and they wouldn't give me a stamp. And so I passed a ruling with the waitresses that anybody that didn't have rolls couldn't have butter. And they were the first ones. And they had just a 10-cent dish of baked beans for their lunch. And then they wanted butter. And the girls told them they couldn't have it. So they were very, very, very put out. Got up, and they never came in again.
And oh, how you missed them.
And I didn't even miss them. I was glad of it because, you know, anyone that would be
Oh,
so
I know. And it made it hard for the waitresses because,
yes.
And that made friction and
yes.
All down the line. And there. I don't know why people want to be like that.
I don't either.
I don't know what satisfaction they
have. I
don't either.
You know? I don't either. It's just as easy to be pleasant as it is to be grumpy.
Sure it is.
Uh-huh.
Sure it is. And that's why the difference between the Mayflower and the Maple Leaf. One was grumpy and the other wasn't.
That's right, that's
yeah. right. Mm-hmm. And want to tell me anything more about your restaurant?
Well,
you were there for
30 years.
And when you went out of business there, then what happened? Did you retire then?
I hoped to, and that's why I quit. And I was only home a few weeks when
the Half Moon
was looking for a short order cook. And one of their employees coaxed me to going down there. And I went down for 2 weeks, and I stayed 12 years.
Long 2 weeks. And that meant that you were in the restaurant business altogether then 42 years, right? 30 in your own restaurant?
42 years.
Well, you certainly know about the restaurant business. Well, then you had some other involvement besides that.
Well, in 1945, I decided I'd raise pug dogs, just for a hobby. And
they weren't a very well-known breed at that
time.
No,
there were very, very few of them.
Uh-huh.
And so I started raising pug dogs, and I continued that for 30 years, too.
I heard. You raised a lot of dogs in 30 years.
Oh, I raised a lot of dogs, and good dogs.
And you used to show them, didn't you?
Yes. I traveled all over by plane and by car and every way.
Uh-huh.
And attended all the big dog shows in New York City and Chicago and Detroit and all over. And I got just dozens and dozens and dozens of
awards.
Trophies and awards and blue ribbons and what have you.
I remember one little pug dog that used to be in the restaurant sometimes. I can't remember what you called him, but he was an awfully nice dog.
Yeah.
Well, you must have met some interesting people when you were traveling around like that.
I did. I met interesting people, pug breeders. The pugs, you know, were originated from England.
Yeah.
And during the years that I raised them, I imported 5 dogs from England.
Oh, did you?
And I met the Duke and Duchess of Windsor in New York at the dog show.
Well,
and
they had pugs, didn't they?
They owned pugs, too. They had 2. And, I met some real interesting and lovely people. And then I went into the raising horses, racehorses. And I bought and raised racehorses. 1958 until 68. Then I quit racing because it wasn't very profitable.
What breed of horses did you raise?
Thoroughbreds. They raced them with sulky, you know.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And I still own 3.
You do. Well, you used to ride yourself a lot, didn't you?
Oh, yes. In 1945, I started a riding academy because there was no gas, and people took to riding horseback.
Uh-huh.
And so I had the south lot. My brother-in-law's, I rented that of him for a light lease on it. And I had it bulldozed down and fenced off and a track put around there. And that one year I had riding horses, rented them out.
Uh-huh.
And it was a lot of fun, but
a lot of work.
And I couldn't do it myself. And so I had hired too much help, so I quit that.
Uh-huh.
Only one year.
Uh-huh. I remember one night I was driving down Maple Ridge Road, and you and a group of people on horseback were at the end of the Bates Road waiting for me to go by.
I rode horseback myself until I was 76 years old.
You did?
Yes.
Well, good for you. Good for you. You didn't let age stop you at anything, did you?
Age was no barrier.
No.
And well, I attribute my long liberty to my active life that I did.
Yes, yes.
I was into everything. Building over houses and renting them and just everything. I don't know why I got into things like that.
Oh, just to have something to do, I suppose. Well, tell me about the houses that you bought and renovated.
Well, I started in with the, it was during the Depression, and nobody had any money. And I happened to have a little saved up. And I decided I'd buy a house and remodel it. And so the first house I bought it through Charles Slatt, the father Slatt, and it was the Dr. James house.
On West Avenue?
On West Avenue. It was a very well-built house, brick. A very well-built house. And I bought that and built it over into three apartments. And then that got me going. And from there on, I bought different ones. I bought three houses on East Center Street. It was owned by Sly. And I
sold
my house of the James house.
Is that the house where the,
it's the house with his cupola on it?
Yes. On the corner.
Uh-huh.
Where the Beckers lived at one time.
Yes. It's on the corner of Oak Orchard and West Avenue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And didn't you two own the Weld house on the corner of West Center and Avenue,
yes,
across from the Baptist Church?
Yes, in later years I bought that home of Mrs. Weld. It was the Acker home on the corner of the West Center and West Avenue.
Oh, yes.
And I remodeled that into six apartments.
Really?
And then I sold that to the Shell Oil Company.
Uh-huh.
That property was zoned, for downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And I had several. The New York Telephone Company wanted an option on it, and Loblaws. And I gave them options every time and didn't want to sell it. And then the Shell Oil Company came along and wanted an option, and I put the price so high that I didn't think they'd take it. And they took me up on it. And
now that would be across the street from Mrs. Curry's house, wouldn't it?
Across from the post office.
Oh, across from the post office, yes.
And the Shell Oil Company built it over into a station, and they operated it for 2 or 3 years, and then it was sold to the Liberty National. It's their drive-in bank now.
Uh-huh. Well, you have changed the face of Medina considerably then, haven't you?
Yes.
In more ways than one.
Yeah, the Baptist Church.
Yes. I joined the Baptist Church in 1913, and I guess I never missed a Sunday for prayer meeting those days, They don't have that now anymore. And I've been a member of the King's Daughters class for 67 years. And during that time, I have held the office of treasurer for 65 years.
Oh, my word. That's a record. That's a record. And you were on the official board of the Baptist Church, or
I was
board
on the,
of trustees, or whatever you call it.
I was on the board of trustees for about 6 years. I've just been into everything.
You must have been on the board at the time my brother was? Robert Willis?
Oh, yes, yes.
Sure.
Yes, I remember him very well. He lives in Florida now, doesn't he?
Yes, he lives in Florida. He comes up during the summer. He still owns a cottage down just west of Chattahoochee. And he comes up for a couple of months in the summer. And he can't wait to get back home.
I also bought a cottage at the lake during the Depression when nobody had any money. I bought the Ronald Clark Cottage.
Oh,
he used to be in the Central Bank.
Yes.
And I bought his cottage. And
that was just east of Chattahoochee, wasn't it?
And that was right in Chattahoochee.
Oh, was it?
It was just as you drive into Chattahoochee, you would turn west.
Oh.
And it was about the fourth or fifth cottage down.
You bought that, and after a while you sold that?
Well, my mother was an invalid for 7 or 8 years. And I couldn't go down there to the cottage and enjoy it because I had to come home and get her up every morning.
Uh-huh.
And so the cottage was more work than it was pleasure for me, so I sold the cottage.
Uh-huh. Well, when you were in New York, you said you met the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. Would you like to tell me about your impression of them?
Yes. They came there to purchase some pup dogs. They already owned two. And when they entered the room, you could hear a pin drop. They were so popular.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looking for pup dogs. And I met the both of them. And she was very handsome and very gracious. Not only handsome, but very gracious. A very lovely person.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you like him, too?
Oh, yes. I was struck on the both of them. And, you know, the British don't like them at all.
Oh, no, I know.
And my Canadian friends, they just thought I was awful for being so fond of the Duke and Duchess.
But you found them charming, and that was it.
Yes. They were very charming, the both of them.
Do you have relatives now living in Canada?
Very distant relatives. My father's people were all over there.
I see.
Not all of them, but I don't know how my dad happened to come over here. I think he was born in Canada.
What did he do? What was his work, your father's work?
Well, over here he worked on a farm for years, and then he worked in the foundry.
Sweat's Foundry?
The Central Foundry.
Oh, the Central Foundry.
I don't know who owned that.
Bert Tucker.
Yes, Bert Tucker.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And his sister, Jean.
Yes.
What did your husband do? What was his business?
Harry was a carpenter.
Oh.
And a... mechanic.
Huh.
And a carpenter.
Uh-huh.
And he worked for Heinz's for a few years, but he didn't like it there. And then he went over to New York Tanners, and he was working there when he died.
And that's where you met him?
No. They had dances and house parties. That's where I met him. And
well, now, about the horses, did you train horses? Did you have somebody to train your horses?
No. I trained one winter out on the track here. It was an awful cold winter. And I wore insulated underwear and boots and what have you. Uh-huh. And people wouldn't believe that it was me out there on the track. And
in a sulky.
Yes. Uh-huh. And I was driving this one horse all the time. And you had to put 300 slow miles on a horse to start with.
Oh.
And then gradually get them up, you know, into going fast. And
you had to break them in like you used to have to break in a car, huh?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
At a slower pace.
They had
pace.
To be broken in slow. Uh-huh. And people used to drive back to the barn because they didn't believe that it was me out there in that cold weather.
But you were enjoying it, I'll bet.
I enjoyed it immensely.
Uh-huh.
And I did it. I enjoyed horseback riding more than anything I think I ever did.
You never drove professionally, though, did
no,
you?
No, no. You have to have a license to drive professionally,
uh-huh.
And it's quite a job to get a license. And at that time, I was getting along in years, so I had to slow down a bit.
Uh-huh.
I was in my 70s.
After working 42 years in a restaurant, you had to slow down a little bit.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's too bad to have to slow down in your 70s. But it's very interesting to have horses. I'm afraid of horses, you know. I'm deathly afraid
of
horses.
Well, my sister's deathly afraid of horses. And I used to get on my horse, and she was a real lively one. When I bought her, I told the man that I bought her of, I said he was going out to Ohio to buy a carload of horses. I said, bring me back one that everybody else is scared to death of, but I don't want to get killed on it. But bring me back one that everyone else is scared to death of. Which he did. And I would get on that horse and I'd ride up to my sister and she'd scream and run for the house, scared to death. She was frightened of horses.
Well, I don't know. I suppose we never lived on a farm, you know, and we used to occasionally go to visit my grandmother and grandfather on the farm. And I suppose my mother told me not to get too close to the horses and the cows, and therefore I've always been afraid of them. They're so big, they seem so
well,
big.
I think the reason I wasn't afraid of horses, my father,
oh,
and he worked in the quarry up here,
uh-huh.
For Delbert McCormick,
oh.
that operated that quarry, and he drove horses, and then he used to break horses for different ones,
uh-huh.
And of course we were out around the barn all the time, and
uh-huh.
got used to the horses and liked
yeah.
them.
Uh-huh.
And once you have race horses, it gets in your blood, and you...
I suppose so. I suppose so. Did you win many races? Did your horses win many races?
Oh, yes. I had a good horse, a mare, and she won one and one for me. And, well, I paid a terrific price for her. Those days, it wasn't much. It was $9,000. But today... A good racehorse runs about $150,000.
Really?
Yes. So she wasn't expensive then, but I thought it was because that was a lot of money.
Well, that was a lot of money in those days.
Mm-hmm. And
what
then,
was her name?
Huh?
What was her name?
Clever's Best.
Oh, yeah.
And she raced until she got lame. Of course, racehorses don't hold up very good because there's... limbs are frail,
uh-huh.
And they go lame. And then I used her for a broodmare, and I raised, 8 or 10 good colts. I sold one. It was an especially good one. I had it partially broke, and I sold him for $9,000.
That's as much as you paid for her when you got
That's
her.
As much as I paid for the mare when
uh-huh.
I bought her.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't lose any money
no.
on my horses. Or on my dogs.
I raised
good dogs.
Yeah.
And I got good price for them.
They were all pedigreed.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yes, they were all pedigreed dogs.
Uh-huh. And how much would you get just for fun for a good pedigreed pug?
Well, I used to sell... the poor quality ones for $60.
Uh-huh.
And then I would get, that's a puppy. And then I would get 75 and from there on up.
Uh-huh.
And I sold an older dog to a lady in Florida one time for $500.
Really?
And I sold any number of them for 250 and 300 and 400.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Well, the pedigree makes a lot of difference.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. And then not only the pedigree, but if they were good, you know, show dogs.
Yeah.
And I raised dogs. I had them imported from England for that reason.
Oh, yeah.
That little black one over there was imported.
Uh-huh.
And I paid $300 for him, plus the transportation over here by boat.
By boat?
Well, the first dog I had brought over was by boat, but the rest of them all came by plane.
Uh-huh. Well, when you take your dogs on a plane, you have to have them confined, don't you?
Yes. When you take them on a plane, you have to have a carrying
uh-huh.
crate.
Uh-huh.
And I shipped dogs all over. I shipped them into Canada, an awful lot of dogs into Canada. And the veterinarian over there got so he could tell my pug dogs. And he said to one lady one day, she took her dog to him and set it up on his table. And he says, I bet I know where you bought that dog. And she says, I bet you don't. He says, in the States.
Mm-hmm.
She says, how do you know? He said, I can tell every dog that Blue Star Kennel raised. I raised them for quality, not
uh-huh.
for quantity.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Good show dog.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Well, the dogs that you sold, did people mostly buy them for show dogs?
Yes, uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Most of the dogs that I sold were for show.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. But they did make good pets.
Oh, yes, marvelous pets.
Well, they certainly are homely things. They look as if they'd run into a wall when their face was plastic and pushed
in. I was at a dog show one time, and like you say, you looked like they'd hit the wall. I was at a dog show one day, and a guy came along and looked at my dogs, and he said, what do you do, run in the side of a barn?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Well, they do look like that.
Yeah.
Well, a Boston Bull looks like that, too, don't they?
Mm-hmm. A lot of people take the pug dogs for bulldogs. But
they're separate breeds.
They're separate breeds completely.
Uh-huh. Well, Mrs. Acker, Ella Acker, always used to have little bulldogs.
Yes.
I don't know whether they were English bulldogs or Bostons, but mm-hmm. she always had a little bulldog, mm-hmm. I remember. And oh, how that dog would bark if you went to the door. And it would continue to bark and growl till she told it was all right.
Mm-hmm.
And then it would just stand close beside her.
Mm-hmm.
Well-trained little dogs they were. Yeah. Well, can you think of anything else? Have you got anything else on your notes there that you'd like to tell?
Let's go back to the Depression years. That was in 1930. From then on, it was much worse then than it is now, this recession. And my husband worked for 25 cents an hour. And they would work 40 hours a week.
Yes, no, I remember that it was 25 cents an hour, and I worked at the Bignell Company at that time, and one of the men, his name was Fred Popplewald, a molder, and he worked piecework. And when he got up to earning $50 a week, everybody had a big to-do over it. It was so unusual.
Mm-hmm.
Now they get that per day.
Yeah. And during the Depression, when I owned the store, it was, it was tramps, we called them, transient people. And they would stop at the store for something to eat. And I used to feed them all. And one of my girls said, Mrs. Gotts, you better quit feeding those tramps, they got your place marked. And I said, well, don't you know we're our brother's keepers? And how do I know that might not be some of my brothers? And so from then on, when they'd see a tramp come in, they'd call, Mrs. Gotts, here's one of your brothers. And there was poor families around town that, they just didn't have food. welfare didn't take care of them like they do now.
Oh, no, there wasn't any welfare.
I don't think so. And, well, my niece was a school teacher, and she knew all the poor families in town because she taught school for it. And there was a family that lived, it was called the Johnson Farm. It's where Waters bought and remodeled that beautiful home up there.
Oh, up just across, just up West Center, up West mm-hmm, Center Street, mm-hmm. extension there?
And there was a family lived there that the man was sick, and they had a raft of kids. And she and I took bushels of food. She took stuff from the farm, potatoes and vegetables and all that stuff. And I took pork loins and gallons of milk and bread and what have you for those people. And you never saw such happy children.
Uh-huh.
As it, and then yeah. It was that day. When I had the store too, the children used to come in there and they'd sit down at the counter and ask for a glass of water. And I knew they didn't want water, it was ice cream they were looking for. And so I asked them, I'd go up to them and say, can I help you? And they said, no. And I'd say, no, this is the day that we're giving ice cream away.
Oh,
and
oh.
I'd give them a dish of ice cream, and they wouldn't go out and tell it to others either, somehow, I don't mm-hmm. know why. But that's the way it was during the Depression.
Well, today's generation doesn't have any idea whatever
no.
about what that Depression was like.
No. This is nothing compared to that Depression.
Oh, no, no.
Well, it wasn't during the Depression either, but it was while I had the store. A man and his wife separated. They had six children. He took three and she took three. And he stayed in Medina, and she went to Batavia to live with her three. And these three kids came into my store and got acquainted with me somehow. And
that wasn't hard to do.
No. And Harry and I never had any children, so I just sort of, you know,
sure.
looked after some of the other kids around town. And there was two boys and a girl. And they followed me around like puppy dogs. And the oldest boy, they were only about, well, say 9, 10, and 12 when they were hanging around to the store. And the oldest boy got married and went to Florida to live. And whenever he come back from Florida to visit, he always looked me up. Mm-hmm. He never forgot that.
Well, no. Of course
what
you wouldn't
I did for
forget
him.
It.
And I used to take him and a bunch of other kids to dog shows and horse shows
oh,
with me, and oh, they had the time of their life.
Did you show your horses as well as race them?
No, I showed the dogs,
uh-huh.
but I didn't show horses.
Uh-huh.
And but all the kids would come down and ride horseback, and was just thrilled to death, you know,
sure.
do it for free.
Yeah, yeah.
And. There was another poor family that lived in the one of my apartments, and they had a bunch of raft of kids. And I used to take them to dog shows, and oh, they got a big kick out of it.
Uh-huh. Well, sure they would. Sure they would. That would be a real treat.
Mm-hmm. So I had a lot of fun in my life.
You sure have had a lot of fun and done an awful lot of good, Pearl. An awful lot of good. Made a big contribution to the life of this community, and I'm so glad that we had the opportunity to make this recording. I'm sure it will prove interest to many people.